Hello, friends. Thank you for listening to Pod of Jake. I'm Jake. You can reach me anytime by emailing jake@blogofjake.com or DM me on Twitter at 0fjake. I always love to hear from fans of the podcast, and your support of the show means a lot to me. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by AG1, the best foundational nutrition supplement on the market. You may have heard about AG1 by now and already decide you want to try it. If that's the case, go to drinkag1.com/podofjake and order your first pack now. If you're not familiar, AG1 is a foundational nutrition supplement with 75 high-quality vitamins, probiotics, and whole food-sourced ingredients to support whole body health. I started drinking AG1 a couple of years ago because it seemed like the most high-quality, cost-effective way to get the vitamins and nutrients I need. Now I drink it almost every day before I eat or drink anything else besides water. It tastes good, makes me feel great, and sets the tone for a healthy day, all for about $3 a day. So if you're looking for a simpler, effective investment for your health, try AG1 and get 5 free AG1 travel packs and a free 1-year supply of vitamin D with your first purchase. Go to drinkag1.com/podofjake. That's drinkag1.com/podofjake. Check it out. Thank you, Anthony, for coming on and joining me on the podcast today. It's a pleasure to have you. You are the founder and managing partner of Skybridge Capital, also the founder and chairman of SALT, which runs the SALT conference, which a lot of people might know. And you're most widely known as the former White House Director of Communications. Famously served that role for 11 days, 11 times as many days as some of the others who served in that role, but, you know, still a short period of time. And you're also the author of several books and host your own podcast called Open Books. So it's great to have you. And I think, a lot of people listening in will know your name and they'll know who you are, but they might not know like the full story. So I think it would be great if you could sort of, as I ask a lot of my guests, just sort of share like the full version, the long version of your story from sort of as early as you're willing to start to where you are today and some of the decisions you made along the way.
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me on. I'm grateful to be here. It's interesting, you know, I had the very famous or infamous run in the White House. I'm speaking to you today on the 6th anniversary of my White House press conference, which was a lot of fun for me, actually. So, when you have time and time elapses and you look back on things, I'm actually very grateful for the experience. It ended poorly. I was summarily fired by the president. People said I was fired because of the comments I made about Steve Bannon, but that really wasn't the case. It was a much broader reason. Him and I were fighting internally about certain things that were going on. And, you know, with Mr. Trump, if you fight with him, it's game over. You know, it's his way or the highway. And obviously, some of the things that he was doing in my mind were destructive. And of course, thankfully, the American people felt the same way, which is why he got voted out of office. But the longer version of my story is, you know, I grew up on Long Island in a blue collar neighborhood. My dad worked for 42 years for the same construction company. He started as a laborer. He evolved into a crane operator. He was also a truck dispatcher. Spent 42 years at that company. Great middle class upbringing. Would never dishonor my dad by telling people I grew up poor. I did not grow up poor. But we had a tight budget, and we were yelled at if we overspent on things. I ended up going to Tufts University, then Harvard Law School, which was also a real blessing to get into Harvard, because I think that was a game changer for my career. It got me job interviews, frankly, that I don't think I could have gotten had I not gone to that high of a credentialed school. Ended up going to Goldman. It was a rite of passage there for me because, Jake, I wasn't ready for Goldman. You know, I had not ever been inside a country club. I'd never been inside a commercial office building. You know, it was sort of an abrupt culture shock for me. I write about this in my first book. I was fired from Goldman, actually, a year and a half after I joined the firm, and then weirdly rehired into the firm about 2 months later. So I had this fun story where I'm fired. They gave me a severance check, then they rehired me, and then they said, "Oh, well, we'll just mark it down as interdepartmental transfer, but can you give us a severance check back?" Of course, I said no. I needed the money. I was trying to pay off my school debt, and so I spent a combination of 7 years at Goldman. Left, started my first business in 1996. Sold that business in 2001, and then Neuberger Berman, the company I sold to, was bought by Lehman Brothers, and so I had the opportunity to work at Lehman for a few years. I met Dick Fuld. I had a great relationship with him. Really liked him. I went to him and said, "Listen, I'd like to start another business." And he was supportive of that. He helped me get SkyBridge started. And so SkyBridge has celebrated its 18th year this year. And so, less my 11-day fiasco in Washington, I've been at SkyBridge. We're a fund of funds, we're a venture capital firm. We have a direct investing vehicle. And then we also have ETFs at our firm. And then the last piece, which is fun for me, is the SALT Conference. With my team, we created a thought leadership conference 14 years ago, which has done quite well. And we've interviewed everyone from three presidents, including Bush, Biden, and Clinton, to secretaries of state, prime ministers, including people like Tony Blair, David Cameron, Gordon Brown. So it's been a fun career. You mentioned my books, and so thank you for saying that. And I'm about to publish. I finished the manuscript for my seventh book. And so the working title of that book is From Wall Street to the White House and Back, Lessons in Unbreakable Resilience. So I'm super excited about that as well.
Yeah, I think resilience certainly seems to be a huge theme in the story, and I appreciate you sharing it. I want to go back to like sort of an earlier moment that strikes me as maybe sort of a turning point for you. Like you grew up, like you said, middle class, just really hustling. Like I think you were 11 years old, you started your first newspaper route and bringing home some money and just sort of grinding like the seeds of any entrepreneur. I think that you see a lot of people I have on the show as guests. One thing though is like when it came time for college, you know, your dad did try to help out a bit. I understand he like cashed a life insurance check and gave you $10,000 to try to help contribute, you know, tough, expensive school and everything like that, and a great school. And so like I understand that sort of that may have been somewhat of an inflection point for you where you're like, all right, you know, fooled around a little bit in high school and like, you know, it wasn't all fun and games. Like you were playing, I think you were quarterback of the, you know, varsity football team. Like you're taking certain things seriously for sure. But this is where you sort of like strapped down and was like, all right, I'm gonna go crush it academically. I'm gonna go crush it in my career. Was that as big a turning point for you as it sort of seems like it might have been?
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, there's absolutely no question about that. I would describe my high school experiences. I had high test scores, I had a good SAT score, but I was sort of phoning it in. And I don't know why I was doing that. I was distracted, probably. I was driving around on my Camaro as a Long Island Guido, if I could be bold enough to say that. But I got into Tufts. I had a good enough academic record, and I was being recruited for football, and so I got in. And obviously Tufts a Division III school, so it was like glorified high school football. But I is an interesting story. I don't even think I've ever told this story before, but I had a guidance counselor by the name of Mr. Zanetti. He was an Italian American like my parents. And he came to see my parents, and I had a choice between going to Binghamton, which is a great school, by the way, is a state university. I think the tuition there, Jake, was like $2,500 or maybe $3,000. And I had that choice, or I could go to Tufts, which was a private school, and I think the tuition there was like $22,000. So very big difference. Put a big strain on my family. But Mr. Zanetti went to see my parents, and in Italian, he spoke to them in Italian. He said, "Listen, he's got to go to this private school. It's up in Boston. You'll get him out of this environment. He'll be out of the state, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "It's important for him, and he should do this." And so my parents listened to that, and my parents didn't really have a lot of money. So my dad cashed in his union life insurance. The cash value on it was $10,000 at the time. He handed me that check. He said, listen, this will help you get started. I also got very lucky. He had a friend of his help get me a job on the dock in Port Washington. So I was making $16 an hour in the summer in 1983 and 1984. And I worked almost every day, but Sundays every summer, collecting that paycheck, which also helped me pay for school. I had to take out loans anyway. But you know, you're bringing up this moment in my life, which I tell people, when my dad handed me that check, and I'm like, oh my God, he's giving me his life insurance policy, and I got to make good on this for my parents. I didn't want to hurt them. It was so important to them that I did well in college and tried to create a good career and so forth. So I got religion, and when I went to Tufts, I locked in. And, you know, I graduated summa cum laude from Tufts. I had, you know, I think it was Phi Beta Kappa, which obviously helped me get into Harvard Law School. But you know, listen, you can step back, Jake. Here's the great irony about life. I could step back and I could paint you this beautiful story, and then you wouldn't see all of the cracks in the story. You wouldn't see all of the setbacks, all the trauma, all the insecurities. You know, I could tell you, hey, you know, I grew up blue collar, went to Tufts and Harvard, then Goldman, you know, built a couple of successful businesses, became financially independent. All of a sudden you see this arc of success and, you know, you don't have any of the blemishes in there. I watch a lot of my rich friends, frankly, do that to their kids. They try to act like they made no mistakes. Their career path went up to the right in a 45 degree angle. And it was absolutely easy for them, and it makes the kids feel bad because the kids are there, failing and you know misfiring and doing different things, and yet they have this picture of their parents where they see their parents in this idealized version. We're doing that in social media now. You know, we're watching each other through these filters, and so but we have an unfiltered life. Yeah, we're looking at somebody else's life through the filter and we're idealizing that. And for whatever reason, due to human nature, makes us feel bad about ourselves, which is something we've got to figure out a way to stop, because I think that's very pollutive to our well-being. But I'm just telling you, I have a great life, but I've had my ups and downs. I failed the bar exam twice. I was a arrogant young kid, wasn't paying close enough attention. I eventually passed it the third time. I got fired from Goldman Sachs, then summarily rehired. I had a huge setback in my career in 1998. We almost went out of business during the Russian ruble crisis. It's 25 years ago now. People don't remember it, but it was searingly painful for me as we almost lost all of our assets. We were over-levered and overconfident. 2008 was another big disaster for us. 2022, probably my worst year, which is great irony because I'm, you know, got enough of a cushion now. But that was 2022. I allowed Sam Bankman-Fried, who was indicted for fraud and is about to go to trial in October, buy into a piece of my business. I believed him. I also had money in the cryptocurrency markets that cratered. It's come back now. But the reason I'm bringing all this stuff up, Jake, is that you can paint this idealized version of yourself, or you can tell people the truth. And I would prefer to tell people the truth because I think it's more instructive and it's more helpful to people than listening to this sort of glorified Hollywood-like nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, your podcast is called Open Book, and you certainly are that, you know, having listened to a bunch of the podcasts you've done prior to this one and read some of what you've written. It's pretty remarkable how honest you are about the ups and downs. And it's like hard to tell even, you know, are all of these ups and downs so much more apparent in your story because you're being so honest about all of it? Or I can't help but think you sincerely have had like many more ups and downs from, like you said, failing the bar, fired and rehired at Goldman, difficulties with Oscar, difficulties with SkyBridge, the White House thing. Almost every piece of your story that is sort of like the greatest piece of success also had like incredible trials and tribulations. So I want to go back to, you mentioned like sort of middle class upbringing, you're working on the docks to pay for college, things like this. At that point in your life, like just sort of looking around and seeing like, a very well-off family or whatever, a guy with a beach house, like that's sort of like maybe part of the dream, right? You just want this like consistent thing. You go to Harvard Law School, you go to Goldman Sachs. Both of these sort of steps are along this path of like, okay, that's like a pretty predictable life. If I can just like not get fired, which, maybe was a little bit more difficult than it might have seemed or whatever. And I know like you sort of weren't, you got there and it seemed like you weren't sort of cut out for the job you were doing, but then they rehired you in the equities division, much better fit for you. And sort of that ended up being sort of like one of those things that getting fired, all things equal, seems bad, but like that's kind of for the best and helped lead you more towards what you do best and things like this. But regardless, Harvard Law, Goldman Sachs, you're like sort of on this track to a pretty predictable, like high degree of success and high amount of wealth. And yet at some point along the way, you sort of decide, I want to go and actually like start my own thing. Inherently like a riskier move going the entrepreneurial path. And maybe that's part of why there's been so much sort of ups and downs and volatility along the way, as I think there is for a lot of entrepreneurs. But what sort of like gave you that itch after like I imagine you sort of wanted this path to success and you sort of finally got on it. And then within a matter of just a few years, basically you're like, I'm gonna go, try to do my own thing and make my own name. What was like what went into that decision to go off and build your own firm?
So I mean, there's a lot there. So let me start with the obvious thing is that no, I think I'm more open about it. I think every person that is an entrepreneur has this sort of trial and tribulation. So just a quick couple of quick examples. Bill Gates failing at Microsoft, can't get the operating system deliverable, not working properly. He has to go to his dad for a $30,000 loan, and he buys a operating system from Digital Research, which was called DR-DOS. He drops the DR, puts in MS-DOS. He sends it over to IBM, and the rest is history. So he's on his way out. Michael Dell, his laptops 30 years ago catching on fire in the summer of 1993. Stocks going from 41 to 7. He's got a bid on the table from Compaq Computer to buy Dell. He guts it out. He goes into the equity financing markets, raises himself money, retools the computers, goes on to create ultimately Dell Technologies worth $75 to $100 billion personally today. I could give you stories after stories. Bezos, Elon Musk on the brink of failure, almost edging towards obscurity in 2008. He's got these two companies that don't seem to fit together, SpaceX and Tesla. Both about to go under. He gets some rescue financing on Tesla. He wins the contract from NASA. He goes on to have great success, becomes the richest person in the US that's either not running a country like Vladimir Putin or a Saudi prince. But the point I'm making is you're an entrepreneur, you're getting your face smashed. Fred W. Smith, the founder of FedEx, said if he knew how hard it was to start FedEx and to successfully run FedEx, he never would have done it. And there's irony in that because he's gone on to create one of the most successful brands in human history. But the point being is entrepreneurs are jumping off of a cliff and they're trying to build an airplane as they're descending to Earth. So my failures are well documented. It's interesting, a 26-year-old copywriter. I submitted my manuscript to the publisher, and they write an inside the jacket description of the book. And as Anthony Scaramucci, who has had successes and failures, and then in parentheses, many more failures. And I laughed. I said, "Okay, but I mean, if you look at my net worth and you look at what I've been able to accomplish, it's not that way." But what happens in our world is we rubberneck. And so I had a terrible year last year. I had this one woman journalist from Bloomberg. I must have dated her, Jake, in my past life or something. I must have upset her somehow. She wrote a negative article about me once a month for 4 straight months with a crescendo article in April that I guess I was, in addition to being a horrific money manager and just a terrible human being, I had I don't know. I guess I must have killed a dog or something. I don't know. It was a nonstop ad hominem of attack of me. But here's the thing. You take a high profile. You're a public figure. You can't go on to expect anything other than that. I'm having a great year this year. It's probably the best year that I've had in the last 15. No journalist will write that. That's not a fun story to write. The fun stories are the car crash stories. So you know, you're also mentioned, well, and I'll just address this. You say, well, I had an easier life at Goldman. And yes, I did. I had an easier life, no question. People would take care of my technology. All I had to do was my job. I was making very, very good money. Okay, but then there's the question about your life. And this is, your podcast listeners need to think about this. What are we doing? Are we living to our fullest? Are we going to take the whole volatility curve of life and take all of the risks and all of those things? Are we going to do that? Or are we going to take the less volatile road, which I would find personally very boring? So I could have stayed at Goldman. I would have had to have become more corporate in my personality. I would have had to have taken a much lower profile. Okay, but just think about this for a second. Then I wouldn't have written 7 books. I wouldn't have been a CNBC commentator. I wouldn't have done reality shows. I wouldn't have spoken at the World Economic Forum. I wouldn't have worked in the White House. And again, it was 11 ill-fated days, but I learned so much about our government. I got to fly on Air Force One. I worked inside the Oval Office. I did a White House press conference. I guess what I'm saying to you, if you step back, the more risk-taking you take, the more exhilarating it is. And when you fall on your face, in my opinion, it's really not that bad. You know, I don't live with regrets, and I certainly don't live with any victimization. I think, you know, my friend who has written a couple of amazing books, starting with the 48 Laws of Power, and then he's written about human nature and seduction, Robert Greene. What does he say? You can't think about the past that much, because we all have regrets. We've all made mistakes. We've all had setbacks. And living with regret and a tale of woe or victimization is just a wasteful human emotion. You know, I'd rather focus on today and what's going to happen tomorrow. But these life experiences, to the extent that I'm able to speak on your podcast or speak to young kids or talk to people, I hope that I'm putting into context for them that it's okay to take risks and it's okay not to be self-conscious about them.
Yeah, it's awesome. I love hearing that all from you. And I think, you know, those are two of my favorite sort of principles that I just try to keep in mind all the time making big life decisions. Is the first is sort of, you know, yeah, I can kind of coast along this predictable path that I'm already on or whatever, but let's take the more volatile path. Let's go into the unknown. And I think with risk is, you know, that's the only way to sort of find reward. And you only get one shot to live this thing, so you might as well sort of go for the unknown and see what happens. And I think it certainly led you in a, you know, a successful direction, and more than anything, maybe just a fun direction that's sort of more aligned with who you are and letting you be who you want to be and do what you want to do. And then the other thing is obviously, you know, just seeing that these bad, seemingly bad things that happen to everyone all the time, you know, they can be for the best. And like, you can look at a bad thing and say, you know, this isn't going to kill me. And not only that, but like, I'm gonna be stronger for it. I, you know, you've told the story of this, your son, I think when the White House thing went down, he's like, Dad, are we gonna be okay? And you're like, not only are we going to be okay, I'm going to be better for this. And, you know, that's clearly been the case since then. And so just taking that attitude to life is like extremely productive, I think. And your stories illustrates that as well as anyone's.
Well, I listen, I appreciate you bringing that up, Jake, but it's important. But here's the thing, like, you know, I believe this even about parenting, to show that I could get my ass kicked like that and get up from the mat, dust myself off, go back to work, and go live my life again without a tale of woe or regret or any bitterness about it. You know, if anything, I've owned it and I've enjoyed it and I've used my sense of humor to describe it. But that's what you got to do. Here's another thing I will tell you about yourself. Other, you know, your loved ones are watching. So you have kids, Jake, or you're too young to have kids probably, right?
Too young for kids.
Yeah. All right. Well, you'll eventually get them if you decide to have them. But, you know, my point is I have five children. And so it's important for me to show my children, hey, man, go for it. It's a short life. What does Mel Brooks say? Relax. None of us are getting out of here alive. And so pick something that you really love and go do that. You'll never work a day in your life. My daughter is just getting back from Europe. She played the lead in an Andrew Lloyd Webber production of Phantom of the Opera in Italy. She had 16 performances there. She had a standing ovation at those performances. She played Christine in that legendary play. And she's back here in the States for a short while. Then she's leaving back for Italy to be the soprano accompaniment of Andrea Bocelli. I'm sorry I'm bragging about her on your podcast, but I'm just pointing out she's doing exactly what she wants to do and doesn't feel like it's work. It's a labor of love. My 24-year-old son is a film director. He's done 50 or 60 music videos for all different types of artists, leading artists, including Drake and Justin Bieber, Machine Gun Kelly, et cetera, Travis Barker. My point is, I'd rather have the kids doing that than me telling them they got to go become a doctor or a lawyer, or they've got to go do X, Y, Z so I look good at a cocktail party. You know what I mean? We sometimes force on our children our wishes so that we ourselves as parents can look better. I'm not interested in that. I'm more interested in letting them achieve or go for their dreams, even if they fail at them, you know. My daughter was touch and go there for 4 years, Jake, where didn't look like she was going to break through. And I said to her, hey, give it another couple of years. Let's see what happens. And now she's had this breakthrough moment. My point is, you know, for your listeners, dig in. Don't take any bullshit. Watch the Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary on Netflix, because his mindset is one that you can learn from about how to, you know, I mean, he went from being a thickly accented bodybuilder to an A-list actor to the governor of California. So, I mean, you got to give this guy credit, you know, and you got to look at the way he thinks about the world so that when you're attacking your dreams or prosecuting them, you can do it with that same zealotry.
Yeah, I've got the Arnold documentary or the series queued up already. So looking forward to watching that. And I'm sure your kids will appreciate the shout outs. And, you know, if we had more time here, I definitely want to dig in on just sort of like principles for parenting a little bit. But I've got a few other questions. But it sounds like, you know, it's got to be very challenging, like the way you grew up and now, you know, having some money and you know, it's a different life that you're sort of raising your kids within than the one that you were raised in, and must be sort of challenging to sort of go through. You don't have as much of a comparable versus sort of the way you grew up to sort of base that on and things like that. But I want to switch gears a little bit. You mentioned 2022, one of the worst years for SkyBridge. 2023, a lot better so far. And a lot of that had to do with, maybe not all of that, but a lot of that had to do with sort of the crypto and just, you know, the markets cratering and the FTX situation and SBF. So curious to hear like a little bit more about that, but in particular, like crypto, you know, we're talking about resilience most of the podcast today. And it as an industry has had a ton of resilience, all of these hype cycles blowing off the top, crashing 90% sort of on repeat every few years for the last 12 years or so. So I'm curious, like what, you know, what got you drawn to crypto in the first place? When did you recognize like, okay, there's actually something here? And, you know, how have you had that? I mean, it's silly to ask you how you've had the resilience, but I guess, you know, your belief in crypto remains unshaken. And I understand you're still like very bullish on the industry, Bitcoin on down. So would love to sort of hear like the origin story of how you got into crypto and sort of what your perspective is today.
So ironically, I got into crypto as a result of my White House experience. You know, I met with two Fed officials in the summer of 2017 that were talking about the potentiality of digitizing the US dollar. You may remember that white paper. It was 6 years ago. I remember thinking, oh my God, I don't know anything about this. People have spoken to me about Bitcoin. I was a naysayer of that. I didn't really understand it. And I remember making notes that I needed to get myself up to speed on this, got myself fired, went back to SkyBridge. I bought the URL skybridgebitcoin.com. I did more homework on it. And then in October of 2020, you know, I had a checklist, Jake, of things that I wanted to see for Bitcoin before I would invest. One, I needed to see it get close to 100 million wallets. I think it was at 80 or 90 million wallets. Yep. Number two, I had to see some regulatory horizon that would be positive for it. And I think, frankly, we got that from the IRS. You know, Gary Gensler doesn't like admitting this, but the IRS called Bitcoin intangible property for taxation purposes. Property is sacrosanct in this country. I mean, it's probably the only thing I really learned in law school. We take property rights in America very seriously. It dates back to the Magna Carta. It's 900 years of British common law translated or crossed over into the U.S. And so if you have a property right, it's inviolable in the country. They're not going to take that from you, but they have to compensate you for it. Even when they took people's gold in 1933, as often referenced, they did have to pay them for the gold. And we know the theory of eminent domain. The government wants your property, they can buy it, but they have to pay a fair market price for it. So to me, I thought the regulatory thing was okay. And then lastly, because of the Mt. Gox crisis, the bankruptcy in 2014 of that exchange, which was doing 60% of the volume, I would tell you that I needed a place to store it, particularly if I was going to make a 7-figure personal investment, a 10-figure investment for my clients. I had to make sure that I was storing it properly, and you can hold it in places like Fidelity. So my odyssey into it was learning about it, not to bore your listeners, but I want them to think about it as follows. If you can take third parties out of transactions, if you can delayer a society, the delayering of a society leads to lower costs, greater economic innovation, greater economic efficiencies. And we have that technology now. We have that capability of doing that. We can trust each other because of the tightness of the technology and the software. That's another big step. Okay, so if I was talking to you in 1993, my desk had things on it like fax machines and printers and all sorts of different devices, probably a CD player or a Sony Walkman that had either a CD or a cassette in it. 30 years later, my iPhone has eaten all of those devices. And so point being is there is tech now in the world of financial services that can eat the intermediary. And if you understand it, you'll get excited about it. And yes, every early adopting technology has an oscillating curve of volatility. Just take a look at Amazon. Amazon has had 7 or 8 50% downturns. I think there was one downturn in the year 2000 where the stock went down 90%. But if you toughed it out with Amazon, it's been one of the best investments in U.S. economic history. And so my point is, yes, I'm resilient, but I'm also a student of history. And I see this as a transformational change. And if I'm right about it, it will scale in a way that will shock people, the same way something like a Tesla has scaled or an Amazon. And if I'm wrong about it, I can tell you what, Jake, it won't be the first thing that I'm wrong about. You can add that to the phone book of things that I've gotten wrong in my life, but I like this and I'm going to stay committed to it.
Right. And it's interesting, you know, you're at this unique position, well, maybe not unique, but a great position to be able to sort of look at things from both, you know, you've got this long experience in the financial industry, but you also did a little bit on the politics side of things, obviously in Washington. And so you have a pretty interesting perspective, I think, on regulation and how all that's developing. But before we get to that, you brought up something interesting of like, you know, like the iPhone 8, the Walkman and all these other, you know, the facts, everything like that. You know, crypto can eat a lot of sort of the intermediaries in the financial industry. And a lot of people who are very wealthy within the financial industry sort of made their money by sort of being one of those intermediaries or middlemen. And so there's sort of this natural, you know, you could see a lot of people jumping on board and seeing the same opportunity that you're talking about and that I see, and a lot of people listening to my podcast who tend to be pro crypto, we'll see. But, you know, you can also understand just from an incentive standpoint, like a lot of these people actually don't really want things to change that fundamentally, like the way things have sort of worked have served them very well. So what are you seeing for, like, you know, for example, all the money managers you work with, or just generally like sort of institutional money perspective? It seems that things are shifting more pro over the last few years, but I'm curious your perspective on that, basically the sentiment among, you know, insiders and institutions.
So, you know, if you had asked me that question a few years ago, people were talking about institutional adoption, and I was telling people, yeah, that's not happening. I mean, people can pretend that it's happening, but it just frankly is not happening. And now, just follow Larry Fink. Larry Fink's telling you that he has demand for it. Larry Fink is letting you know that he thinks that this is going to be a storage of value. It's ultimately going to be digital gold. And so he's a very smart guy, and he's reflecting the demand that he's finally seeing for it. So, you know, we got there 3 years before he did, and took our lumps for it, but I'm scaled into it now. You know, I own it, and I own it at much lower prices than where it is today. And if he's right, and I predict that he will be, and we eventually get a Bitcoin Cash ETF in the United States, I predict that will happen as well. You'll see an incredible amount of demand for this. So you know, is this a 10x in 5 years? I think quite possibly it is. And remember, you say, oh, 10x, that sounds ridiculous. Well, look at some of these stocks. Okay, Apple is a 10x in 8 years. You know, how, you know, Bitcoin to me is a story that is not going anywhere. And it is, if you think about the immutability of Bitcoin and you think about the tangibility of Bitcoin, it's going to be with us. And could it be a $15 trillion asset? I think the answer to that is yes, because that's only a 50% more than gold. And in many ways, it's just way better than gold. So I don't know. We're at a $400 billion asset today. Could it be a $15 trillion one? I believe it could. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but could that happen over the next 15 years? Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with you. I think it could happen quickly. It could also happen very slowly. I look around at people, you know, I'm in my late 20s, and I look around at friends of mine, smart friends and dumb friends for that matter, just whoever. And like, you know, I can count sort of on one hand the number of people I know who are my age who own gold. And like almost everyone I know has at least some Bitcoin or some Ethereum or whatever it might be. And is sort of playing around in those markets. So it only goes to sort of logic that as these, you know, as my generation and others that are younger get older, you know, gold might be less interesting. And of course, sort of silly to argue against something like gold that's, you know, had its value for thousands of years. I'm sure it'll continue to have a lot of value for the long term, probably. But that doesn't mean Bitcoin can't come in and be a store of value as well in a similar capacity that gold has been, and obviously offers a bunch of other functionalities as well. So I know we're up on time, but I appreciate you coming on and sharing your story and talking about some of this resilience and a lot of lessons from your story that I think are really useful for listeners to digest and, you know, try to apply in ways that they can, if they can. But it's been great talking with you. Where can people go? And, you know, where do you want to point them to, your books or your new one coming out, or SkyBridge?
I'm reachable on Twitter. If you direct message me on Twitter, I respond quickly. I'm at Scaramucci on Twitter. I have a YouTube channel. You can subscribe there, where you can get the podcast in its video form, or you can go to any podcast repository, including Spotify and Apple, and find Open Book there. It's a once a week podcast. I just finished interviewing Daniel Silva for his new best-selling book called The Collector. And so, you know, listen, it's a lot of fun. Here's the other thing I'll tell you, I'm turning 60 in January, Jake. I'm hoping, if the good Lord gives me health, the next 10 years will be better than the last 10. And that's how you got to think about your life.
Amazing. Love it. Well, thank you again for the time. I really appreciate it, and look forward to keeping in touch.
God bless, man. Thanks, Jake.